You might remember that Twitter and other forms of social media have been a hotbed for a discussion about Nigeria's missing girls. Now we move to a different conversation that's taken over social media for the past few weeks. We're talking about World Cup. Argentina beat the Netherlands yesterday to advance to the final. Well, they will face Germany. The Germans dismantled Brazil 7-1 on Tuesday, which sparked a social media firestorm. Twitter says the match was the site's most discussed sporting event ever. 35.6 million tweets went out during the game, and I may have had one or two of those. We wanted to get the latest on social media and the tournament, so we've asked ESPN senior writer Pablo Torre to speak with us. He was at yesterday's game, and he's with us now from Brazil. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Of course, Michelle. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, better now that I'm speaking to you. So what are people talking about now that we're a few days away from the finals?
Well, it's really funny because I'm at these games. I'm physically sitting by these fields, and I'm still on Twitter monitoring everything. This is kind of where the conversation is happening. This is where you sort of get a sense of what the public is interested in, and it tends to be the case. I mean, we can rewind a little bit before we look ahead to Argentina, Netherlands versus Brazil-Germany. Brazil-Germany was this firestorm, was this sort of meme factory, because it was this most unexpected, most insane game, arguably, in sports history. And so the conversation reflected that. Yesterday, it was kind of a lot of memes about people falling asleep. I mean, that was the relative tenor of that game. It was way more boring. Now, looking ahead, I mean, Germany-Argentina, you know, I think the conversation is suffering a little bit because Brazil is not there. But I do think you're going to have one of the great superstars of the game, the superstar of the game, of the sport, in Lionel Messi, who is going to be in that game playing against Germany, the presumptive favorite. So we're going to have some storylines to monitor going ahead.
Well, the Brazilians can't be happy about arch rivals Argentina in the finals. Has that been fodder for some discussion?
Funny. I was just watching TV here, Brazilian television, and there was a segment involving a psychologist and a very sad interview with a child in a mall, and it had to do with Brazil losing, but also Argentina. I mean, the international rivalry between those two countries, who both, you know, talking to people in Brazil from Argentina, there is a sort of mutual sense of exceptionalism. And I think Brazil, in South America specifically, with regards to soccer, football specifically, but Brazil, to have Argentina make it to the Maracanã in Rio de Janeiro, where they expected and really demanded their team to take them, Brazil's own team to take them, the fact that Argentina, their most hated international rival, is there, is going to – that is certainly one constant stream of anger flowing across the internet and flowing across real life as well in Brazil.
So who are some of the most active players on social media, and what have they been up to? I know a lot of people in the U.S. are used to following people like LeBron James, for example, maybe Chris Paul, like people who are active in like the players associations and stuff like that. But so who are some of the most active players, and is it very individual? I mean, is it the kind of thing where it's just kind of that person's kind of personal? It's like a personal thing that they like to do, or do the teams encourage this?
You know, it's an interesting dynamic, because I was way more versed in the NBA and those characters you mentioned and how they approach what we've called and continue to call branding, right? Personal branding. And LeBron, it's funny because LeBron right now, we're monitoring Twitter, seeing that's where the news is breaking about where he's going to play these coming years. And in soccer, in world football at the elite levels, there's a very similar dynamic that runs parallel. And I think of a couple of examples. Number one was Neymar, who was a superstar Brazilian player who got injured. Playing against Colombia, had a vertebra fractured by a Colombian player on a tackle. Instead of holding a news conference, instead of talking to reporters, Neymar released on social media a video addressing fans. He's much like a LeBron James is theorized to be doing, bypassing everybody to connect directly to fans and monetizing his own influence, his own popularity. And on the other end of the spectrum is a player, Luis Suarez, Uruguay's star player, who was, if you missed this incident, was basically caught biting the shoulder of an Italian player, one of many times he's done this in his career, and he had to apologize, and he did so. Well, first he refuted the fact that it was an actual bite on social media, and then he of course, admitted to it once he realized, presumably, that everybody had seen teeth hit flesh. So you have these players dealing with the most contentious and most intriguing and most compelling storylines directly on social media, as opposed to going through guys like me at this point.
You know, it's interesting, though, that people are saying that it's kind of a two-way street. That, for example, we mentioned that the Brazil-Germany game broke Twitter records. The most watched World Cup semifinal game in U.S. history, which is interesting because even though the U.S. wasn't in it, and people say, well, the U.S. is only interested in matches that the U.S. is in, and that proved not to be the case. But some people think it's in part because of Twitter. What do you think about that?
Well, the reason why I think there is some validity there, and I think we should always caution ourselves in understanding that Twitter still represents a small percentage of the overall human population. However, when you talk about a promotional tool, I mean, Twitter is really, really intertwined with live sporting events. And I'm acutely familiar with this, and that's why I'm monitoring. That's why every journalist really is monitoring Twitter while they're monitoring the game, because you're getting news, you're getting information, you're getting jokes. And really, Twitter feels like a sports bar. It's a global sports bar, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
And that's why everybody ends up winding up there, even if they know it's probably best to sometimes take a step away from the screen.
So what were some of the funniest memes?
Well, I think for Brazil, I mean, you had these actually fairly impressive artistic renderings of someone reimagined the Brazilian flag with a goal that was full of seven soccer balls. I mean, you have these memes. I mean, there were blogs that were promoted immediately, sadbrazilians.tumblr.com, which was just a blog of everybody who was crying during these games. It was really, I mean, the televised experience is obviously the central focus, as it should be, but in terms of supplements, the internet gets to sort of hone in on all these little jokes that you probably end up talking about even more with the people next to you, people you've never even seen before, because there is this opportunity for, you know, what we call, in a cliched way, viral content ends up actually just being sort of funny and interesting and stuff that you may have missed the first time around.
So I'm not going to ask you to predict the winner of the final between Germany and Argentina, unless you want to, but I do want to know who's got the better social media game.
Oh, man, I think, you know, until further notice, I think we follow sort of the alpha dog strategy here. Much like LeBron James at the top of his food chain, Lionel Messi is at the top of soccer. However, Germany, they have some very active players. Lucas Podolski, his username is lucas-podolski.com. I mean, you have guys who are really embracing the kind of social media world.
Okay.
And as for the prediction, I cannot say anything good about Argentina until I leave the borders of this country, so I will abstain
okay.
from that.
Okay, all right. Well, we're going to follow you because you've got mad game.
Oh, yeah, and follow me, right.
That's right, exactly. Paulo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN, one of our regular barbershop contributors with us from Brazil's capital, Brasilia. Paulo, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
It's been a little more than a year since the National Security Agency learned it had been had. Edward Snowden, the disgruntled former NSA contractor, snatched many documents detailing many of the agency's classified programs. NPR's David Wellner recently met with the NSA's top technology official and asked, could it happen again?
One person above everyone else at the NSA is in charge of securing the eavesdropping agency's digitized secrets. He's Chief Information Officer Lonnie Anderson. He's the one who got called on the carpet last year, a dozen days after the world learned of Edward Snowden's heist.
White House asked me on 17 June, do you have another Snowden? I answered as honestly as I could. I didn't know. I learned within seconds of saying that, that wasn't the answer they were looking for.
The answer the White House wanted was no. Anderson says General Keith Alexander, who at the time was the NSA's director, offered some advice.
The director's guidance to me, Lonnie, is lock it down. Figure it out and lock it down.
I meet with Anderson in the black-tinted glass office block that's NSA's headquarters outside Washington, D.C. He tells me what he sees as the root of the agency's problem. Edward Snowden was actually authorized to access the top-secret documents he took.
He didn't breach, he didn't hack. His job was to move documents from a TS high environment to a TS, an additional authorization high document.
TS means top secret.
And that's what he did, and along the way he decided that he would not only do that, but he would make a copy for himself.
But a former insider says Snowden's security breach could have been prevented. Bill Binney was considered one of the NSA's most brilliant cryptomathematicians ever. He quit the agency 13 years ago, disgusted by what he calls its disregard for Americans' right to privacy. As a technical director there, Binney says he developed an internal security program to monitor every keystroke made on NSA computers.
The reason that Snowden was able to do what he did do is because NSA never accepted our proposal to do that program in 92, 93. If they did, as Snowden downloaded it, we would have picked him out right away.
The reason the NSA rejected his internal security program, Binney says, is it was considered far too intrusive.
They said, I don't want you monitoring me when I'm analyzing this data. You just go away, I'll do my job, you know? Okay, we don't want that kind of big brother watching us.
The spies didn't want to be spied on.
Exactly.
The NSA has come up with a different fix to prevent another security breach like Snowden's. Anderson, the technology director, says once it's in place, a lone wolf at the agency would no longer be able to act alone, as Snowden did, to access and remove documents.
The process we're moving to, we're not completely there yet, is physically badge in with someone else. If you want access to a rack of equipment, you'll have to unlock that. Someone else will have to issue you that key. If you then want to change operating software, someone else you'll have to call. So it's not you and me. It's a series of two different people.
This is a crazy way to do it.
That's former NSA technical director Binney's take on the agency's plan requiring two persons to access a classified document. What the agency really needs for internal security, Binney says, is a computer program that, unlike humans, won't fall asleep or need a bathroom break.
What they try to do is plug really big, complicated problems with people, and people just aren't good enough to do it.
The NSA's Anderson concedes his agency simply does not have the resources for people to continuously monitor one another.
We'd bring the agency to its knees if we tried to do that.
Anderson insists that even if Bill Binney's keystroke monitoring program had been adopted, it would not have prevented the Snowden security breach.
Is there a silver bullet here? You know there's not. You're never going to be completely secure. A trusted insider with a lot of skills can do damage.
Still, Anderson says he would have a better answer now to what the White House asked him a year ago. Do you have another Snowden?
I can tell you today, we don't have another Snowden.
You're certain about that?
I'm certain we don't have someone trying to do what Snowden did.
At least not in the way Snowden did it, Anderson says. But he adds that he worries all the time someone else inside could try something else. David Wellner, NPR News, Washington.
Europe's highest court ruled a few weeks back that people have what's been called the right to be forgotten. That is, if a European doesn't like what pops up about him or her in a web search, they can try to get the link to that information removed. And that means Google is now receiving thousands of requests to hide search results. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports on how Google is responding.
Google could have dragged its feet or waited for privacy regulators in the European Union to give more direction. Instead, the search giant moved quickly and put together an easy-to-use form.
Yeah, I'm on it right now.
Rafael Rodriguez Lopez is a journalist in Vigo, Spain, and he's sitting in front of his laptop.
It says in Spanish, how to remove content from Google.
He's volunteered to fill out this form asking Google to hide a search result about him, one that shows he shared a dumb article on racy ways to get rid of the common cold.
I think anyone could see that I shared that kind of article.
It takes him just a few minutes to check the right boxes and explain his rationale. He also has to upload a picture ID, say from school or a driver's license with the serial numbers blacked out, to prove he is the Rafael Rodriguez Lopez in question.
Okay, I think that that's it.
And he's impressed. Typically, the official processes take a lot of paperwork and visits to bureaucracies.
This is relatively easy and quick for the Spanish standards, I have to say.
The form may be simple, but the underlying law is not. Privacy and freedom of speech are both written into the European Union Charter. Under the court ruling, search engines have to balance these bedrock rights. Google feels stuck between a rock and a hard place. In a statement released on Friday, the company says it's received over 70,000 applications. It is putting every single one through human review. And the court order is very vague and subjective. Internet law expert Nico van Eyck at the University of Amsterdam points to a key legal difference between Europe and the U.S.
The European concept of privacy doesn't include harm as a necessary circumstance. Everyone can claim his own privacy rights independent from whether there is a direct harm involved or whether it's a slander case.
Some very tough cases are coming up. One Dutch newspaper reports a woman who survived a serious illness wants to hide an article that describes her ordeal. Potential employers could discriminate against her. Even if the story is accurate, Van Eyck says, Google has to concede if the link is inadequate or irrelevant or excessive.
It leaves only a very small margin for journalists and media claiming the possibility to report on individual persons because it's of public interest.
European media has criticized Google for playing with those margins.
Are you being deliberately overzealous in applying it?
Absolutely not.
That's Google spokesman Peter Barron in a BBC interview. Google told a BBC reporter that his article on a big bank wouldn't appear in some search results. The reporter was outraged. Suddenly, a politician or banker that's the subject of investigative reporting could game the system. Only later did Google clarify the article wouldn't appear only when you searched for the name of one specific person who left a comment.
We have to balance the need for transparency with the need to protect people's identity as well.
Privacy advocate Joe McNamee in Brussels says Google is either going overboard with the privacy ruling,
or they are accidentally or deliberately giving the impression to the media that the ruling is far broader than it actually is.
Google says it disagrees with the court ruling, and the company's interpretation is very much a work in progress. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
This afternoon, the Pentagon announced the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter will not fly to England this week. It was supposed to make its international debut there at the Farnborough Air Show. That's bad news for Lockheed Martin, the F-35's manufacturer. The company is dependent on foreign sales to make the troubled program work. From Farnborough, Christopher Wirth reports.
The F-35 is the most expensive defense program in U.S. history. So far, it's racked up nearly $400 billion in costs. But Al Norman, the plane's chief test pilot, argues that's money spent on radar-evading design and high-tech computer software that is far more advanced than anything before it.
This technology makes the F-35 a quantum leap in capability for fighter aircraft.
Norman is giving tours of the F-35 at what would have been its grand entrance on the world stage. Countries like Britain, Australia and Italy have placed orders for the fighter jet. Foreign delegates have come to kick the tires and maybe even watch the plane fly. But after more than a decade under development, all Norman has to show them is essentially a big model airplane.
What we're walking around right now is a full-scale mock-up of the aircraft. The actual airplane is not right in front of you right now.
Yeah, can I tap this?
Oh, what's sure,
this
made sure. Of? Yeah. This right here is wood. But
Wood?
I think it is.
Actually, the folks at Lockheed Martin tell me it's fiberglass. But in any case, Lieutenant General Christopher Bogdan, who oversees the F-35 for the U.S. military, says not having a real plane at the air show has made it harder to promote the F-35 abroad.
We did want to show off the airplane to the partners and to the foreign military sales customers.
He says that's because those foreign countries are key to making sure the U.S. can pay for the fighter as it ramps up production. Right now, estimates for a single F-35 range from $112 million, according to the Pentagon, to closer to $200 million. But Bogdan says the more firm orders foreign buyers place, the cheaper the price tag should become.
Without them, we cannot drive the price of this airplane down far enough for it to be affordable for everybody. So it is crucial for them to buy the airplanes they've committed to.
And Bogdan says those partner countries are committed, but many have lowered their initial orders in recent years. For example, Britain originally planned to buy 138 F-35s. Today, the number stands at 48. Canada, Italy, and the Netherlands have also wavered as defense budgets have been cut. And Justin Bronk, an analyst at RUSI, a British think tank, says the risk is the F-35 could enter what's known as a death spiral, where as orders drop, the price per plane starts to spin out of control.
It's very hard for governments to justify politically buying an aircraft that is so eye-wateringly expensive. So any negative publicity, the fear would be you'd see further people cutting their orders to the point where even the U.S. just can't afford these aircraft.
Lieutenant General Bogdan does not fear a death spiral. He says costs have actually dropped over the past 4 years, and his goal is to get the F-35's price down down to around $85 million each, although he says any uncertainty does not help that process.
As people waver, it makes it harder for us to project how much the airplane is going to cost. So what we're really looking for is stability.
To get that stability, Bogdan says he's here talking with partner countries about what he calls a block buy, which would allow partner nations to pool their orders and purchase F-35s at a wholesale price.
My incentive to them is, if you commit to buying X number of airplanes over 5 years, I'm going to give you a discount.
At the same time, America's allies may not have a choice in the matter. The F-35 is the only advanced fifth-generation fighter available to replace aging military fleets, and any alternative could be decades in the making. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Wirth in Farnborough, England.
Now, the Federal Communications Commission has been encouraging comments on its website about net neutrality. When you ask people on the internet to comment on the internet, you get comments, a flood of comments, in fact, so many that they crashed the FCC website yesterday on what was supposed to be the deadline for public comments. The tech problems are buying some more time. Here's NPR's Elise Yu.
Net neutrality may have a snooze-inducing name, as comedian John Oliver has famously noted.
The only two words that promise more boredom in the English language are featuring Sting.
But it is important to the future of the internet, and hundreds of thousands of Americans clearly care about it.
Our electronic comment filing system was definitely overwhelmed.
That's FCC spokesman Mark Wigfield. He says so far, the FCC has gotten 780,000 public comments about a proposal on the table to let internet providers like Comcast charge content companies like Netflix extra fees to deliver faster content to consumers. 100,000 of those comments came in on Tuesday alone, the original deadline for public commenting. It buckled the FCC site.
So because of that, and just to be sure that everyone can have a chance to submit their comments, we are extending the deadline until midnight on Friday.
That buys time for more people to weigh in, but it's unlikely the net neutrality comments will surpass two other notable FCC-related events. 2 million comments were registered on media deregulation, and the FCC received 1.4 million comments or complaints about Janet Jackson's infamous Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction of 10 years ago. Elise Hugh, NPR News, Washington.
Let's say you're shopping on a smartphone. You click on the shoes or the book that you want, and then when you get to the shopping cart, you stop. You abandon your virtual shopping trip. Well, the credit card company Visa says that's a big problem for retailers, and today they're rolling out a brand new system to get us to spend more money online. Here's NPR's Aarti Shahani.
Visa is actually trying to fix two problems with one swipe. First, shopping on your smartphone is great until it gets tedious and you have to use your big thumbs to type in lots of digits.
All of the wonderful benefits that consumers get from using their mobile phone, you know, when you're out and about, kind of fall apart when you get to the payment part of the process.
Jim McCarthy is Visa's global head of product.
So with Visa Checkout, what we're trying to do is make it really easy for the consumer to complete that transaction.
Under the new system, every Visa customer gets an account that stores their credit card number and billing address, and retailers interface with Visa to accept that account. So when you're out and about in the digital mall,
you'll just provide a username and password, and all that information will be provided securely on your behalf to the merchant for checkout.
Behind the scenes, there's a big security upgrade. Visa, MasterCard, and American Express all work together on a new technology called tokenization. Under it, the 16 digits of your credit card stop running out in the wild and stay inside the card company's server walls. The retailer just gets a randomly generated 16-digit token that can't be used anywhere else. So if hackers break into Target, the tokens they steal are no good at Amazon or Pizza Hut.
What we're trying to do is make the whole experience of someone trying to steal cards less profitable.
The new Visa checkout system could give a boost to online shopping. Jamie Vigiano, head of marketing at the online company TaskRabbit.com, says when you exchange cash or give a credit card, it feels like a financial transaction. A login and password? Don't.
There's the psychological impact that I'm not forced with any payment guilt, at least at the time of purchase. I think there's the potential that people would spend more.
Stephen Murdoch, a cybersecurity expert at the University of Cambridge, is watching with some skepticism. Over in Europe, he says, when banks improved security, it also became harder for some customers with fraud claims to get their banks to listen.
The rationale is that because the system is more secure, then any fraud that happens must be the customer's fault. But that is obviously not true because it's just more secure. It's not perfectly secure.
Given Visa's massive size, today's move could set a brand new industry standard for online shopping. But Murdoch says not even Visa can eliminate all risk. Aarti Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.